John DeFilippo is out in Minnesota. What happens to that Vikings offense now? Plus, is there a blueprint for stopping Sean McVay's Rams? Why Steelers-Patriots promises a ton of points? Why Amari Cooper has broken out? And a fairly in-depth discussion of cartoons. We've got everything you could possibly want on the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling. He is in only mildly cranky Andy Benoit today, so it'll be a good show. Andy, we have some games to preview, but we're going to have to start with John DeFilippo here and his dismissal from the Minnesota Vikings.
Well, and that's good because I think that Dolphins-Vikings game, it has playoff implications. I think it's kind of an intriguing
Absolutely.
Matchup too, so we can probably parlay it into Week 15 discussion.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dolphins are a half game better than the Vikings right now. Who would have thunk it? DeFilippo specifically, though, this it just seemed like, and you wrote about it for the MMQB, it seemed like a dynamic that was just not going to work, and especially as the losses piled up a little bit, and you know they're trying to get a run game going. I'm not sure they have the personnel to have the kind of run game that Mike Zimmer thinks they should have.
And I imagine John DeFilippo would agree with you. They do not have a strong interior offensive line in Minnesota. They're not great at tackle. So there is not the semblance or makeup for a power run game, and they're not an outside zone running team. So it's easy to say, oh, I'll run the ball more, but the personnel's not there to run the ball more. The personnel's there to throw receiver screens. It's there to throw underneath. It's maybe quick tosses on the perimeter to Dalvin Cook, which sometimes come out as runs, sometimes as passes, depending on how they're relayed over to them. It's this whole run the ball, not run the ball thing. I think it gets way overblown. I'm not saying DeFilippo should not have run the ball more. I'm sure there were times where he could have. But the idea that that would be the offensive identity for Minnesota, it's not going to go that way. That's not what they're built to do. That's not why they signed one of the most expensive quarterbacks we've ever seen. What's interesting, though, Gary, I'm sorry, but this gets into the personnel discussion of Cousins. And these are why this needed to happen long ago, because DeFilippo and Zimmer did not know each other until DeFilippo interviewed and got this job. You sign Cousins, who's always been good in a run-based offense, kind of a run-pass-married offense, like what the Rams do now, but what McVay did with Cousins in Washington. But they don't have the personnel for that in Minnesota, and they gave him a pass-minded offensive coordinator. So a bunch of ill-fitting pieces here in different directions.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say that they made a huge investment in a quarterback, and obviously you have two star receivers there, but I guess it comes back to the conversations that we've had a couple times where you don't necessarily need an elite run game to make that passing game go, make that play action game work. They did not have that in Washington with Kirk Cousins, even though their offensive line was good. It was banged up, but it was a good unit. They were never a dominant run game that Kirk Cousins then worked off of, but there was some semblance of the threat of the run, which, you know, allows the execution of a play-action play to work.
Right. I believe unless you've got a mobile QB, a Lamar Jackson, a Cam Newton, these guys that you can scheme uniquely with, maybe a Josh Allen, we'll see one day, but unless you have someone you can scheme at quarterback into your running game, if you don't, then your running game's only as good as the passing game you build off of it. And the Redskins under Cousins were good because their pass game came from their run game, even though their running game wasn't very effective. Their pass game, their play-action game, as you just said, was. Minnesota did not have a great play-action passing game under DeFilippo because they didn't have a run game identity. And we just discussed why we think they didn't have the run game identity. So I understand why people would say, and I even wrote it, yeah, you need to marry your run and pass concepts a little more than the Vikings have, but in order for them to marry, you have to have run concepts, and yeah, they didn't have that. So it's at the end of this, though, Gary, the whole point is it's a young offensive-minded offensive coordinator, of course, and DeFilippo, and an old school run oriented head coach, and those two things do not jibe well, and the Vikings found that out.
And Kevin Stefanski gets the promotion from QB's coach to offensive coordinator here. So you would think it'll look a bit more like they were last year under Pat Shurmur. Stefanski was here a year ago. They blocked him from interviewing elsewhere, in fact.
Yeah, you would think that. It's a matter of what Cousins can handle, though. Remember, you can't just rewrite your playbook here in December. I mean, everybody's offensive and defensive identities are set, so you're tethered to the things you've been practicing all year. I really like Kevin Stefanski, though, and I think if this goes well for the Vikings, let's say they put up 30 points a game and make the playoffs and win a playoff game, something like that. Stefanski, remember Matt Nagy came out of nowhere in the second half of last season with the Chiefs and just soared up coaching lists all of a sudden when he got the play calling duty. I'm not predicting Stefanski to be the next Matt Nagy and be a head coaching candidate, but I could see him becoming he's one of these young offensive coaches. I think he was behind a lot of their passing game last year, the details of their pass designs. He's worked with Bill Musgrave and Norv Turner, some of the most respected architects in football. I think he'll become a hot name if this goes well down the stretch, but he's in a little bit of a tough spot because presumably he's under the same directions that DeFilippo was under, the run game stuff.
Well, let's talk about this game coming up Sunday against the Dolphins. They'll host Miami in a game that they now need if they're going to make the postseason this year. Vikings defense has been playing well the last couple weeks. It seems like they have, after something of a rocky start to the season, they have really returned to the kind of level that we'd expect them to play at. This Dolphins offense, though, I mean, they put up 34 points last week. Granted, six of them were maybe not the most trustworthy and non-fluky kind of points, but
those project well to this matchup, that hook and lateral play?
They should write that into the playbook. They should run that a couple times a game, I guess.
Yeah, open with it. And I would make sure that Kyle Rudolph is on the field somehow. I'd put out a package that gets him on the field for the Vikings on that play.
If Kyle Rudolph comes out into the defensive formation, they have to call that play.
They have to audible to it.
That would be foolish for Adam Gase not to have that ready. They did go punch for punch with the Patriots in the first half. That was a game where each team was putting up touchdowns. It was a 27-21 game at halftime before the Dolphins kind of stalled out. But where is this Dolphins offense right now? Because we've talked about Gase a little bit, and we talked a couple weeks ago about how he was maybe a little over conservative on some third and long plays when they lost at Indianapolis, but. It's coming to the point where they're going to have to make a decision on Ryan Tannehill. Do they have something to build on offensively here?
I think they're a big play offense, and if they get their big plays going, then it works out for them, and if they don't, then they're going to get 18 to 20 points and maybe win or maybe not, depending on their defense, and probably not more often. So Devontae Parker, Kenny Stills on designer shot plays, which come from your running game, as we've talked about, and I think it's a pretty good run game. I think their O-line, Jesse Davis at right guard, is coming off a good performance. Frank Gore always looks utterly professional and respectable on film. So can they run the ball and generate big chunk plays through the air? And if the answer is yes, the Dolphins are in it. If the answer is no, the Dolphins are usually out of it. The other thing that'll be interesting, kind of shifting back to the other side of the ball, because I actually thought Miami's defense looked okay again. I know New England moved up and down the field on them at times in the first half, and it was some of the play action in breaking route stuff that the Patriots are so good at that generated success. But I thought Miami's defense looked the best it's looked all year against the run when they were facing New England. Kiko Alonso, Raekwon McMillan, two really inconsistent linebackers, were highly consistent, highly effective, and dialed in. If they play like that again this week, and that's a big if, I've learned that with these guys, but if they do, it's going to be – that'll make this whole run discussion even more interesting, because I don't know if Minnesota won't run the ball on them if the Dolphins play as well there as they did against the Patriots.
I was going to say, Raekwon McMillan is probably a guy you could argue is maybe trending up. This is his first season after he misses rookie year with the torn ACL. Kiko Alonso, though, you don't know quite what you're going to get week to week.
Oh, he's erratic. And I looked up, he's going to cost $3.5 million in dead cap money next year if they cut him. I think his cap number, I want to say it's around $8 million. I think we'll see him gone next year. I don't know how they feel about Jerome Baker, their third round pick this year. He's rotated in at times with McMillan, but McMillan, they want to be the number two guy, their number two nickel backer. But if they feel Baker can play nickel with McMillan, then they'll get rid of Alonso. Because it feels like he's always, and I don't mean to be ripping him the week after his best game, but it feels like whenever something's going wrong with that defense, if he's not the culprit, he's somehow tangentially involved at least. He is such a reactionary player.
He's on the wrong side of a lot of highlights is how I think of it. I feel like every time they, like that Panthers game last year where the Panthers just sort of might have scored on 1,000 consecutive possessions if the game had lasted that long, it was picking on Kiko Alonso. He does some good things too, though.
Yeah, right when you think he's bad, he does something great because he is a fast player. He's an athlete. I think he is more physical than his body type suggests. So he's a hard guy. If you were dating him, he's the one you'd keep breaking up with and coming right back to a little bit. I mean, that's the kind of player he is.
Fair enough. Let's go to Eagles-Rams here, the Sunday night game. This is going to be in L.A. The headline of this one, look, Eagles need to win out. They're not out of it. They do need to win out here. Unlikely to have Carson Wentz. That's Ian Rapoport's report. Some back spasm for Wentz. He will probably not play this week. He might not play again this season, depending on how it plays out. But we're back to Nick Foles here with this offense. And I don't know, Foles struggled in the regular season last year before they really clicked in the postseason. But I feel like, you know, with the fact that they really don't have the same kind of run game they had a year ago,
right.
And I think this is such a worse spot for Foles at this point. I just don't see how they're going to how this is going to work out well for them.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's not the same, and no one's talking about it. It's not an expansive running game in Philadelphia this year the way it was last season, for whatever reason. And that's going to be a big deal with Foles. I mean, I learned to tread lightly because he was so good on third and long at times in the postseason last year, but I do think he's the type of QB that has to have a supporting cast role for him. He's got to have something around him, and he's a piece of the game plan, not the backbone of the game plan. On the other side of the ball for this one, I am fascinated to see. We've seen the Rams now go 2 weeks in a row struggling on offense against two deep matchup zone defenses. The Lions did it to them, which is a little bit outside the Lions' profile, but they had success. And then the Bears did it, and it's exactly in the Bears' profile. The Eagles are typically a one-deep safety defense, but lately with all those injuries they've had, they've played a little bit more two-deep. In fact, against Dallas spread out two-by-two formations all game long, it felt like. Philadelphia played some form of cover two or cover six, which has different zone elements. Whatever it was, there were two safeties back deep on almost every snap. And actually, a few snaps where there weren't was the Amari Cooper 75-yard touchdown play that would not have been available throw if there had been a safety over the top. So I think we're going to see the Eagles go to more two deep coverages this game, and we're going to find out about the Rams, because if they struggle against the Eagles in two deep, a team that doesn't play a lot of two deep stuff, hasn't practiced it, is bad on the back end right now, then there's for sure a blueprint on this offense. My guess is they'll be fine. The Rams will put up 35 points, but that's the part of the game I'll be watching, is what do they do against the Eagles secondary?
Yeah, that'll be interesting, because when they squeak by the Lions, I know the final score was not really a squeaky score, but
right.
You know, we kind of said it's just one of those days for this offense. And then when they got beat up by the Bears, we said kind of, well, one of those days, plus it's a cold weather game against an elite defense. They really need to do something this week to restore my confidence, and that's really all that matters.
I have had so many Rams coaches text me saying, what's Gary think of us right now?
Yeah.
How
I hope you're passing along. I'm a little bit shaky on them right now.
Okay.
Not feeling good. Bulletin board material. Let's go Steelers Patriots.
How often is there actually a bulletin board anymore with that?
That's
stuff
actually a good
posted
question. I haven't been in a locker room in probably like 8 years because I am a shut in at this point. I'm reclusive.
Yeah.
I just stay in my basement all day. But I don't know. That's
where is the bulletin board? I'm always surprised when I go to visit NFL teams. Actually, the Rams would be one of these teams. How many motivational signs are posted around and little sayings? That stuff does. I wouldn't think it would resonate with professional millionaire athletes. I wouldn't think it would do anything for them. But I think coaches seem to think it does. I mean, the cliches are very much alive in the NFL.
Well, I would just think technologically, I mean, everyone's got their face buried in their phone every free moment. You're going to need some sort of different way to communicate the kind of things you want to communicate. I think you sound like a group text at that point or something.
See, the Rams, remember at our MMQB retreat the year Peter King made us all put our phones, and he brought a paper bag and said, put your phone in the paper bag so we all had to pay attention. And there was one guy on our staff who didn't do it at the end. We're going to let you get him. We're not going to name names. But we've, for the most part, people put their phone in their bag. It was a hard day. Hard day to sit there and look at each other and interact and make eye contact and listen to everybody. But the Rams have a super paper. They've got little boxes on the outside of all their meeting rooms where you deposit your phones. The phones all have – there's chargers in those boxes. So phones do not make their way into these meeting rooms where these signs are hanging on the walls. Guys still have to see these signs, these win your matchup, play your day, or whatever the hell these things say.
Okay. That was when Connor Orr was doing the searching for the future of defense story, where he went out to a couple NAIA programs, and Army is not an NAIA program, but they were a very good defense this year, almost beat Oklahoma in a huge upset. But Jay Bateman, the defensive coordinator there, was saying how he would send clips. He would text clips to guys and say, tell me two things you just saw here. Like, give me two original observations of the upcoming opponent. That's
a good idea too.
That's how you communicate now, or you just take everyone's phones forever, one or the other. Let's go. Late afternoon game here. Steelers Patriots. Let's talk about the defenses on each side, because we'll start with Pittsburgh. They, we know Roethlisberger missed time last week. That's probably what cost them the game in Oakland, and they were sloppy in the Denver loss and that sort of thing. But, we talked a little bit about it when they lost to the Chargers on Sunday night, even though there were some fluky plays. Chargers exploited the Steelers' zone coverages with Keenan Allen. This is the second straight week where they gave up probably more points than you'd expect they'd give up. I'll say that about the Raiders, that they're not overwhelmingly talented on either side of the ball. But is there an issue with the Steelers defense right now? And are they limited with what they can do to fix it?
Yeah, there might be, because the Chargers exploited their zone coverages, and so the next week against the Raiders, they came out and the Steelers played more matchup coverages, whether it was pure man-to-man, which they did a lot, especially out of their dime package, or if it was a matchup zone where they played zone, but if anyone ran into your zone, you basically became a man defender on that guy, and that was their other part. And the Raiders ultimately beat them. Raiders exploited. They got better. They had two long scoring drives or two scoring drives down the stretch. Derek Carr made throws. The Raiders have maybe right now the worst wide receiving core in the NFL. Jared Cook's having a great year at tight end, so it's not like they have no weapons, but it's your alarm bells go off if the Raiders are beating you in your matchup coverages. So that's two different game plans getting exploited 2 weeks in a row. The easy solution for all this is your pass rush step up and start dictating the game more and not letting these play designs unfold, not letting your secondary have to react to everything. But I don't think the pass rush against Tom Brady is going to be a huge factor.
Yeah, and I mean, look, Jared Cook had his way with Morgan Burnett in that matchup last week. Whatever you think of Gronkowski, you have to give him some attention, and then you unlike when you face the Raiders, now you got to deal with Josh Gordon, you got to deal with James White and stuff like that. This seems like a very problematic matchup. Patriots are problematic for everyone, but for what the Steelers are rolling out on the back end right now, it seems like this is pretty much the worst matchup you could possibly have come in.
Did you just say whatever you think of Gronkowski, which kind of tacitly implies that he's not even on Jared Cook's level? Are we really accelerating the Gronkowski conversation to this degree? I happen to think Gronkowski's still a superstar.
Poor man's Jared Cook. Yeah.
That's
a superstar. If I just think that highly of Jared Cook, Andy? What if I think Jared Cook is just a
living legend? Well, then I'd say you've never watched a Raiders run play ever, or an old Titans run play, or a Rams run play.
I just want to point out, when Jared Cook played for the Packers, we had this conversation a couple times. We both realize we are big Jared Cook fans.
Maybe I'm just a big fan of what I'm a big – I like Jared Cook, the receiver, when he splits out wide, yes. which the Raiders have done with him a lot this year, in fact. That's where Burnett got most exploited, and Gronkowski splits out wide by himself like Cook does at times. So I like that Jared Cook, but I'm taking – if we're going overall football player, come on. Rob Gronkowski as a blocker is still one of the – he's probably one of the 10 best tight ends in football now.
I'm not saying Gronkowski – when I said whatever you think of Gronkowski – people do think Gronkowski is declining. I think that's a fair take that he's declining. I was not comparing him to Jared Cook. I like that you weren't
there. I know you weren't. I was slandering you a little bit on that, but I think we're getting a little carried away with this Gronkowski decline. If we didn't know what he was, if we're comparing Gronkowski to, I guess it's, I'm about to describe declining here. We're comparing him to being the best tight end in the NFL by a wide margin, which he's been for a long time. Now he's a top three tight end. And I think that we lose sight of what that means. We think, well, he's in decline. I guess technically he's declining. He's still a top three tight end. He's still as good as anyone in the league on his best day.
Well, people just look to the future sometimes, Andy.
This game will take place in the present, I'm told. They're going to play in the present this week.
They are.
And I think the Steelers are going to have trouble with Gronkowski, just like I think you're saying they will, even though we're arguing here.
I mean, that's what happened last year, and everyone obviously remembers it was the Jesse James game, but that was a Brady to Gronkowski drive that gave the Patriots the lead late in that one, and it took a Juju Smith-Schuster big play to put the Steelers in position to even take the lead on that Jesse James, what would have been a touchdown this year, but what was not last year.
That was Sean Davis who was in coverage in that game, and Davis is now the free safety.
Yep.
So it'll be, like you said, it'll be almost certainly Morgan Burnett. I bet they double Gronk. The more I'm thinking about this, I think it'll be Edmonds and Burnett, maybe L.J. Fort, their rising linebacker, depending on how they – the other question, what makes this so hard with New England always is who covers James White, because White and Gronkowski very often align on the same side of the field. So it's hard to double them both. And that's for the Steelers to figure out. I'm glad I don't have to figure it out. That's probably L.J. Fort on James White. Because then you go to, well, you put your slot corner on White, but now who covers Edelman or Chris Hogan when they're inside? Patriots have a lot of weapons. You're right. They're a good team.
They are. They really are. This is going to be a huge issue for the Steelers on Sunday. They're going to have to score a lot of points. Presumably, Roethlisberger will play in this game after the sort of mysterious circumstances around the rib injury last week. Under that assumption, this Patriots defense has sort of stagnated. I feel like this goes even all the way back to last year where they had problems in the secondary early, and then they got those straightened out, and then they just sort of have, you know, floated by as like a middling unit for a long time here, and they didn't look good in Miami last week.
They don't have a ton of speed, so there will be times, I think, where they don't look good because they're just not a dynamically talented defense. A lot comes down to how their corners are playing, and Stephon Gilmore, for the most part this season, has lived up to true number one corner status. That's what they've asked of him. You have to have two of those guys now when you face Pittsburgh because Juju Smith-Schuster is gaining on Antonio Brown as Pittsburgh's best weapon. And it's to the point where Smith-Schuster is now lining up in some of the spots that Brown for the longest time has been the guy to line up there. So who covers Smith-Schuster and how? And that New England's gone with J.C. Jackson lately, their undrafted rookie, and he's been very good on vertical routes. But in breaking stuff and anything that changes directions at the intermediate level, I think he's been pretty average on. So will they? And that's something you got to defend the all routes when you take on Smith-Schuster. He is a highly refined receiver already, and he's going to be one of the best in the NFL within a year if he's not already that. So who covers Smith-Schuster? And maybe as we're thinking about it, would they put Gilmore on Smith-Schuster and let their best guy go one-on-one and then double Brown with two other guys, which we've seen New England take that formula a lot in the past?
Yeah, I think that's what I'd do.
Which would mean probably both McCourty brothers. Yep. Jason, because Jason plays, and Brown's not a slot guy very often, so Jason McCourty be playing outside in this game. That's the equation right there, though. If it's the Steeler wide receivers, and if you could keep Smith-Schuster and Brown together, if you can keep him under, let's say, 150 yards and a touchdown and a half as an over-under, I think you beat the Steelers' offense. If you let those guys get rolling, though, the Steelers' offense is hard to contain. They absolutely would have won the Oakland game if Roethlisberger had stayed out there. Their passing game is hard to handle right now.
Yeah. Let's do one more game here. Let's do my favorite game of the week. This is the Dallas Cowboys going to Indianapolis. We've mentioned these units in passing. I just wanted to talk a little bit about this Colts offensive line, and we all heard about the no sack streak and all that stuff. So they played well, and obviously they've gotten better as the year has gone on. This Cowboys defensive front, though, not only the linebackers, but the pass rush has continues to perform as maybe not an all world level, but certainly a B plus A minus type of unit here. I think that's a great matchup.
I do too. I like that matchup a lot, and it's going to be DeMarcus Lawrence, the DN, against Braden Smith, the rookie right tackle who just faced J.J. Watt last week, and he got beat on some snaps, but he lived to tell about it, and he's still the guy. What the Colts did against Houston was go with six offensive linemen on about a third of their snaps, and then they actually subbed out Eric Ebron, a blocker very similar to your buddy Jared Cook, Gary, and they put in Ryan Hewitt in his place. So they went really run-heavy in their personnel package, and they started out terribly, and then as the game progressed, they generated some big play-action shot plays out of that package. So that's the one way you deal with the pass rush, is let's go run looks and be selective with how we go downfield out of it. The other way is to do what I think they will do and what they've been doing, which is dink and dunk quickly and put the game more in Andrew Luck's hands.
All right, that will be a good one right there. One more thing on this game, and we're actually going to sort of transition to the mailbag portion of the show, but this is a question from Jocelyn, an old friend of the show. Mentions Andy, more analysis please on Amari Cooper succeeding in Dallas and what went wrong in Oakland, because we have just sort of said Amari Cooper's been really good. We haven't really gotten into any real details. I'll let you go first, Andy, because I have a theory of my own.
Okay, I'll make it quick because I want to hear your theory. Amari Cooper is a very good... What, are you laughing? I want to hear your theory. I'm excited.
No, you don't.
Why you don't? Why would I not? What are we doing?
You're not going to like it when you hear
right
it.
Now? Oh, crap. Okay. I think Cooper is a very good intermediate route runner. And in Oakland, there were a lot of times that he was open and the ball didn't go there for whatever reason. I'm not saying Derek Carr was screwing him over. I'm just saying it was the stuff he's doing well in Dallas. You saw him do well at time. You saw flashes of it in Oakland, but now we're seeing a sustaining shining light here in Dallas. So he's playing better. It's as simple as that. He can separate at the 10 to 15 yard range on his routes really well, and those are routes that Dak Prescott is comfortable throwing. Then the other thing he can do well that we didn't see in Oakland, remember, he struggled catching the ball at times in Oakland. He was not the same confident receiver. He hasn't had any issues with drops in Dallas so far, and it's improving in his run after catch. The confidence is translating to a better run after catch weapon. He is very good at transitioning his body from receiver catching the ball mode to receiver turning and running upfield mode. So that's the Cooper story. And some of these deep downfield stuff that he's getting are sideline contested catches. I think he's at his best on slants. Now, what's your theory?
No, I totally agree, because part of my theory was the fact that he is more confident catching the ball is allowing him to create more after the catch, and that's been a big deal for him. For whatever reason, he just seems more comfortable catching the ball in Dallas than he ever was in Oakland, and maybe that has something to do with the fact that in Oakland, especially this season, the early part of the season, he was getting open and not getting the ball. I just wanted to make the point, and listen, I am 100% on the Amari Cooper bandwagon now. I was not before, but I am now. I will learn from my mistakes and move forward with this. But I think he's had some good matchups. I think he's had some favorable matchups. And even that first game when they played the Titans on Monday night, and it was Malcolm Butler playing a lot of, off coverage. And look, Malcolm Butler has struggled this year. I thought that was a good matchup for Cooper to sort of get him going. And I think he's had some good matchups here. A couple matchups with the Eagles.
Now, you think I won't like that because that's kind of like a strength of schedule thing?
A little bit.
No, I don't mind it, because what you hear all the time, every coach says NFL is a matchup league. It's about matchups. So I love that point. I think I'm looking now to see who he's played. No, I am 100% on board, and I wished I'd said it. But I'm looking to see if I agree with you about who these played. They did face the Eagles, Atlanta, Washington. They've got some guys there. I don't know if he's had only favorable matchups. He faced the Saints, Marshawn Lattimore.
Didn't they have Eli Apple on him a little bit that game?
I should know that off the top of my head. I think it was Lattimore. Apple guarded Julio Jones the previous week, and we wondered if they would do that for Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
But they went out there with Lattimore on him. But let's see what his numbers were against some of these guys, because I don't remember what he did on a game-by-game basis either.
I just have a tough time shaking that, because that Cowboys debut against the Titans, I remember thinking, like, wow. Malcolm Butler stylistically is a really good this is a really good night for Amari Cooper here. This is a nice way to start your career with your new team.
So his big numbers, 75 yards against Philly. This was a few weeks ago. Then 36 in a quiet game against Atlanta. 180 on the Thanksgiving game against Washington, where we saw that run after catch prowess. And then the Lattimore game, 8 catches on 8 targets. I'm sure they weren't all against Lattimore, but that's you take that. And that kind of game was a defensive slugfest too. And then the 217 yards against the Eagles, Bosby and some of those backup corners. I think your theory is worth keeping an eye on.
That's fair enough.
As much as I'll give it.
Look, last 3 weeks, though, I mean, 30 targets, 26 catches, and 473 yards is absolutely superstar performance, no matter who you're going up against. So, he's turned it around. Good for him. He's been really good.
This, just to kind of round our bases here, this week it'll be if Cooper lines up on the right side of the formation, it'll be Pierre Desir, and if it's on the left side, it'll be Quincy Wilson most likely, or vice versa. I mean, those guys can move around too, but those are the perimeter corners out of nickel for the Colts. And then Kenny Moore is their slot corner, and he's become a very good blitzer, incidentally. Those Colt corners, just like the rest of that Colt defense, they're playing better than you would guess. Those are not household names at all, but those guys were pretty. I thought they handled DeAndre Hopkins really well last week.
All right, Andy, let's break open the mailbag. Although I wanted to mention something quick before we did open the mailbag here. So I guess this is a bit of a question from me or a comment from me to the mailbag, but to Andy Benoit. Those of you who are somewhat familiar with Andy know his thoughts on the tackle eligible plays, and it didn't really move me. I didn't really think anything of it. I thought they were fine. I didn't have a strong opinion. I do want to officially declare that I am joining Andy Benoit in his campaign to change the tackle eligible rules. The Taylor Decker play, rewatching that this week for me is sort of the moment where I kind of decided enough is enough with it. Because if you...
The one against the Rams. The Decker touchdown against the Rams.
I sent you the video, Andy, last night. You know who else has had enough of this is Mark Barron, who, after that play, was just incensed and annoyed and just... His facial expression said it all. He's rubbing his, he's doing the wave your jersey thing, and he's saying, he's just mouthing like, who was eligible? And, Taylor Decker, who's lined up at the regular tackle spot, all of a sudden is eligible on that play.
Because he happened to brush his chest before the snap and tell the referee, hey, I'm not eligible, but now I'd like to be, so here I am. And the referee announces that over the speaker, and people say, well, Barron ought to listen to the ref. Well, Mark Barron is – how do we know he's not communicating with his fellow defenders out there at the time or talking to his coaches on the sideline, looking back? These guys – name one other situation in football where a player before the snap, so basically live action, because now where the chess match is happening, name one other situation where the player is responsible for hearing a message relayed by somebody not with his team, a third party, the official. A stadium announcement is what made Taylor Decker eligible, and we expect Mark Barron to process all of that. It's stupid. It's not creative. People say, oh, it's creative football. It's not creative. It's boring, and it's unfair to the defense. I think the solution, do you want to steal my idea? Because I think you like my idea, don't you?
No, I like your idea, but it's your idea, so you get to say it.
I think you make the first two guys on each side of the ball automatically ineligible. So the guy at the guard and the tackle spot, wherever they are, they're almost always going to be next to the center. But sometimes we see teams split these guys out in these crazy Hugh Jackson-looking formations that he used to do with the Bengals. But I think you make those spots ineligible. Every other spot is automatically eligible. And so you get rid of this whole player declaring or not declaring for eligibility thing.
Yeah. No, I like your idea. I said if they're not going to change the rule, which hopefully they will soon, and you know, we've talked about this, it's going to take like a touchdown in a close Super Bowl or close playoff game for anyone to actually get fired up about this enough, like it happened with the Patriots and the Ravens, and then they made a tweak to the rule then a couple years ago when the Patriots did some things with eligible and ineligible receivers. Yeah, it's if they're going to keep the rule as is, I think you have to make such a show of the referee announcing it. He has to like go to the ball and you know, the same way they would if there's a, you know, if there's a late substitution and they're holding up the snap.
Yeah.
Like he has to make sure that all 11 defenders are clearly focused on the official when he is making that announcement, as opposed to the way it usually goes where he's kind of just sort of, I don't know, standing somewhere in the backfield and makes the announcement and then we are expected to just absorb that. Because I've been at games where I haven't picked up on that announcement because it seems like such white noise. I'm also not on
right.
the field, but still.
But also, remember this. Mark Behring, so when they announce Decker's eligible, 68 is eligible, and he'll repeat it. The ref will say it twice. 68 is eligible. We don't know that Mark Barron knows who 68 is or where to look for that number. Mark Barron's been scouting the tight ends, the backs, the running backs, the receivers. He hasn't been looking at which linemen are at which number. He knows the numbers of the tight ends and the other players. So even if you say 68 is eligible, you still got to find where 68 is. And if he's tucked in at his usual left tackle spot, that's not where your eyes are going to go first.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I will never match your passion on this, Andy. But I am with you that
the two things that get me fired up, you know this now, this one and the jersey number thing, which ironically, you could argue my theory for or my idea for how they should deal with this eligible tackle eligible thing, it kind of negates the jersey number thing. If everybody's just eligible at certain positions, that in theory would do away with the need for jersey numbers because you don't have to declare anymore. I still want the jersey numbers there. I love the structure they bring to the NFL. They mean something. It's another reason I don't watch college. You look at college, can't tell who's who out there. Numbers range from everything. I think one guy's number was OY last year, if I'm not missed. I mean, you just see all kinds of labels on guys. I hate it.
Oh, boy. Let's go to actual mailbag questions. This one's from Volstead. This is we're poking the bear here, Andy. This is Volstead asks, I'm trying to understand Andy Benoit's objection to strength of schedule discussions. Is every game a coin toss? If the Rams played the Cardinals 10 times, does Andy think the Cardinals will win 5 of those games? Seems to me if there's no strength of schedule, then there's no point in trying to figure out which teams are good and which teams are bad, and the entire profession of football analyst goes out the window. I'm with Volstead.
Oh, wow. I didn't see the end of that email. That was a destructive ending to his point. I don't know. I hear what he's saying. What I don't like about the strength of schedules, the way it's treated, implies that the Rams would beat the Cardinals 10 times out of 10 times. You just go, that's a win, that's a loss, that's a loss. It just does. That's my issue with strength of schedule, is we assume that it tells us something that it really doesn't tell. Of course the Rams are better than the Cardinals. Of course they'd win probably 7 or 8 times, we could guess, if they played. But that doesn't mean 100% of the time, which is how strength of schedule is almost always presented.
All right. We'll keep on working on that. We'll soften you up. This one's for me. This is from Matt. Gary, I have just one important question. Given how you often speak of Artie Boo Earns and also have a son named Bort, do you ever think of referencing Bucks place kicker Cairo Santos as Cairo Santos L. Halper? Just curious. I hadn't thought of it, but I will now. And I hope the Bucks go out and sign a long snapper LP Latisor, so it'll be Santos L. Halper and Laddie on the same unit there. That's a
now,
Simpsons deep cut for you.
Yeah, that's a very deep cut. I'm going back 20 years in my Simpson memory. I remember that's the dog, Santa's little helper, mm-hmm. And I think you lost me at that. Do you still watch The Simpsons?
I will rewatch the seasons one through eight. I occasionally have the new ones on. I don't want to sound like every Simpsons douche out there and say like the new episodes are no good, but I don't know, new episodes are not that good.
What do you think's a better show, The Simpsons or Family Guy?
American Dad is my favorite network.
Is it really?
I guess that's TBS now. I watch all the Adult Swim stuff, so I want something as weird as possible. I think American Dad is funnier than Family Guy. Family Guy, I only watch because it occasionally has something that is sort of weird enough to catch me off guard, and that's the kind of humor I want at this point.
Yeah.
Whereas, I don't know, Simpsons is just kind of... I watched... weirdly enough, it seems like every late national game seems to be like CBS this year. I only base that on the fact that I feel like I've seen a lot of 60 Minutes this year because I'm usually still working and don't bother turning the TV off until about 8:30 or so. And,
except on the West Coast, by the way. So you're not on the West Coast, so you get to see the 60 Minutes.
I feel like this week was like one of the first times I had The Simpsons on after the football ended.
I think Family Guy got accused of copying The Simpsons years ago, and to their credit, they came out and said, yeah, we basically did. And the part that they didn't say was, not only did we copy them, but we did it better than they do it, and that's why we're the best show now. But anymore, it feels like The Simpsons now copy Family Guy. I don't remember The Simpsons doing the cutaway jokes the way they sometimes dabble in now.
Yeah.
Family Guy brought that to the table.
You don't think Family Guy is better than the classic Simpsons, the 90s Simpsons. Tell me
that's
you don't
hard.
Think that.
I'm skewed
no, it's
on that.
Not hard.
Simpsons
is better.
This is a jersey number issue for you. You didn't even let me get into my first sentence.
Is.
I was going to say, Gary, before you interrupted me this time, it's hard because I was a kid during those classic Simpsons and I wasn't allowed to watch some of them, which made them that much better. If I watched those when I was a teenager, like I did Family Guy, where my parents had just thrown up their hands and said he'll become whatever kind of man he's going to become at this point, then I probably would have liked Family Guy better than The Simpsons. But there was the mystique of The Simpsons in those early years.
I was just going to say your parents are lovely people, but this sounds like a issue of bad parenting, that you were not allowed to watch Simpsons as a child.
The Simpsons got that ban on The Simpsons got lifted because we finally got my mom and dad to sit down and watch a Simpsons episode with us, my sister and myself, and, hey, just watch, and if it's inappropriate, fine, you can continue the ban. If it's not, give us a chance. I was like 13 by this point, and my parents couldn't help but laugh at so many spots that they had no choice but to turn down the ban, and we were able to watch it from then on.
There you go. Yeah, most of
it was it was the one where they got Burns and Homer got stuck under the big pile of snow on the company retreat.
Oh,
remember
Mountain
that one?
Of Madness. It's a pretty good one.
Oh, you know the names of them. Wow. Yeah. Okay, anyway.
No, I occasionally go to classic Simpsons trivia with some friends down in Brooklyn. We have not taken a title yet. We have a couple of runner-up finishes, but we'll
are you serious?
There. We'll get there.
That seems like something that would happen in Brooklyn, too.
It's a very Brooklyn thing. It's a little too much of a Brooklyn thing, and I never lived in Brooklyn. But I feel a little too Brooklyn-y while I'm there, but it is enjoyable. And they play some of the old episodes, and it's fun. But most of what I watch is like Adult Swim now, and I watch the weirdest stuff on Adult Swim that comes on at 4 a.m. and is meant to be for people who are of an altered mind. One more question here. This is from Parker. This is a long one. I'll try to abbreviate it as much as possible. Basically, he is referring to the Raiders, and the Raiders are going to be potentially homeless next year, and you know they might play at UNLV, they might play in San Diego, San Antonio, etc. But Parker wants to propose that they become the International Raiders with an agreement with the league that their schedule would be travel friendly. The Raiders would play 4 home games in Mexico City, 4 home games in London. Ideally, the schedule cadence would be 2 road, 4 home, 4 road, 4 home, and finally 2 road to finish out the season. In short, you would group up the, you know, what would be the international games, that they play 4 games in London, 4 games in Mexico City, and go from there. And obviously Parker makes the point. It's not only a win for the league that wants to expand internationally. It's also something of a test case for if you want to eventually put an international team in London or in Mexico City or something like that. Andy, how do you feel about the 2019 Raiders being the international, the world's Raiders?
I guess I kind of like the idea on the surface. My guess is there are 1,000 logistical obstacles to that, and that probably takes more than a few months to put together, which is what they'd have to organize in a few months now.
But Parker does point that out in his question. I did exclude that. But
all right, so Parker's smarter than you allowed him to look on that back there.
It is.
But I don't know. I guess I kind of like the theory. I don't know where I don't get into this the political side of the Andrew Brandt side of this as much anymore. So I care where they play, but not enough to think about, hey, where are they going to play next year? I'll be interested when they decide.
I just put out one thing. London obviously is a big body clock issue. If they do put a team there eventually, and that seems to be the front runner, if they're going to have an international team, that's something you're going to have to deal with at some point. I hesitate to say this only because I don't want to sound like a certain politician who may currently be the president of the country I live in, but teams are kind of, they have security issues with Mexico City. That seems to be a big emphasis. I don't know if they put a team down there for a month-long stretch is how I put it.
Well, that gets any international thing, that's one of many facets that's going to be tricky about it. It's different cultures and who's going to be in charge and who's going to hold who accountable. That's a hard one to deal. I don't think we talk about it very much, but American government and the NFL, there's a lot of back and forth there. And there's antitrust laws and all that stuff that there's different rules in place for some of those things. So yeah, I hear what you're saying in the big picture of it.
Yeah, this did almost become a very Andrew Brandt end to the podcast here. I do want to mention this one last thing, Andy, because Mountain of Madness, now I think about it, has maybe my favorite line of all time. Probably not of all time, but it's probably top 10 for me. When Bart and Lisa offer to help Smithers, and Bart sells it as, I have a watch with a minute hand. What time is it? 12:80. No, wait. What's after 12? 1? No, after 12.
It was great in the 90s. It's a great show in the 90s. I'll give you that.
Did you like my reenactment, though? My dramatic reading?
It was okay. It was all right.
Okay. Watch with a minute
the
hand.
Simpsons,
gets
to me,
me
are a, the Simpsons are a possession receiver who could get 10 to 12 yards a catch in terms of how funny the show is. 80, 90 catches a year. Very good. Family Guy is that potential number one receiver who might not catch everything you throw him. In fact, he'll drop a lot, but he's going to get 5 or 6 80-yard touchdowns, or not 80-yard touchdowns, but he's going to get 5 or 6 home run touchdowns every year.
What's your American
Dad
take?
So Family Guy is Deshaun Jackson. Let's put it, that's what I'm trying to, how about that? And The Simpsons would be, Adam
Jerry
Thielen.
Rice.
Jerry Rice is better than a possession guy.
I know, but The Simpsons are Jerry Rice because you got that wrong. What's your American Dad take? Just real quick before we go. I don't know if I want to hear it, but now I have to hear it.
Very average.
Oh. Okay.
Very average.
That's not too
show.
Offensive. I'm telling you, seasons 4 through 8 of American Dad are pretty phenomenal.
Well,
open your mind.
See, nobody talks. It's not a season show, though. Like, that's how you talk about, like, Breaking Bad or one of those shows that has a narrative. These are standalone episodes.
Yeah, but there's a different feel to each season because they have writers coming in and out.
Oh, my God. You are really into this.
It's a different team. The team they had seasons 4 through 8 was phenomenal.
All right,
that's a wrap for the show. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, who make us sound smart. And thank you, as always, to producer Shelby Royston and the guys at Canes 13 who make us sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Deep Dive NFL Podcast. Andy and I will be back in your feed first thing Monday morning to break down all the Sunday action. I'm going to miss this week. I'm not doing the gambling show on Friday. Jimmy Train is Scott Gramling, and I believe Ben Teitelbaum is going to pinch hit for me on the gambling show coming out on Friday. Make sure you check that out. Go one back in your feed, and you'll get Jenny Brentis, Connor Orr, joining Albert Breer to break down the biggest news from around the league. We ask that you subscribe to the MMQB podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, radio.com/10things, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.